And as a matter of fact, my first 60 doors were from property managers, and I bought them seller financing. It was neat, right? Because for a lot of these older landlords, they wanted that monthly payment to be higher. Because I mean, they were in a position where they already had lump sums of cash. Like, they didn't need a crazy down payment. So my average down payment I would give these guys was 10%. I bought a couple of apartment buildings, no money down too. That's how great it was.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Daniel Kwok is one of the Kwok brothers, and he is considered the creative negotiator as he handles all of their investor relations, their conflict management, and their partner management. Daniel, welcome to the show.
What's going on, Sam? Thanks for having me.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. You know, I must admit that I think that's the shortest bio. I think we're on episode, like, I don't know, when this goes live, 350 or so. So I think you
won the award. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. But I think you win the award. Congratulations to you for the shortest bio I've had coming on this show. So that's tons of fun. It leaves a lot to be discovered here in this call. So, you know, the same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. Can you briefly tell us where you started, where you are now, and how you got there?
Yeah, I'll just kind of share the story of what I accomplished and how I accomplished it. By the way, one of my biggest pet peeves is when I'm listening to a podcast, because I'm a very avid podcast consumer.
Okay.
And the person that's on will spend like 5 minutes talking about who they are and what, you know what I mean? And it's just, I'm just like, get to the good stuff. Like, show me how you did it, right? So I'll do my best to get there as fast as possible. So long story short, I'm an immigrant to this country. My parents and I, my dad's a pastor, so I'm a pastor's kid. And we immigrated to this country when I was 5 years old. And, wow. You know, when you grow up poor, you learn poor. So it led me to me being 18 years old. I had negative $187.65 in my bank account. I had a couple maxed out credit cards and, you know, I had no network. So for a lot of you guys that are listening to this episode and you're going, man, like these guys, they've got some special genetic or they've got some, you know, special advantage over me. And, you know, I can't do it. And I've got all these reasons. Trust me, I was that one guy that was like, right. Oh man, but his dad is a, you know, is in real estate already. And, you know, he has a network and he's got, you know, his dad can give him a small loan of $1 million and all these things. And I didn't have that. So I had to kind of be creative. I had to learn how to scale on my own. And the way I did it pretty much was at 18, I decided enough is enough. Right. And we all have those moments where it's like, you know what? I got to do something here. There's a reason why I'm sure you started this podcast, and I'm sure there's a reason why people are listening to it right now as we speak. And so there's a reason there. And my reason was, for me, it's like, you know, I want to do a lot of good things for the world. You know, I'm that guy where, you know, I don't need to be making, you know, millions of dollars every single year, but what I do want to be doing is giving it away, right? I love helping, you know, nonprofits and missionaries, especially, there's constantly having to raise money. So I wanted to be the guy who can, you know, fund them and provide that way. So I decided enough was enough. And what I started doing is, one of the things I really would recommend to people, especially when you're looking to scale your commercial portfolio, is just submerge yourself in what you're doing. And when I say submerge, like, I mean, really submerge. Like, don't just go to like one meetup a week and say, oh, well, that's good. I've done my part, right? And, you know, I checked the boxes. Well, no, like, you have to make it who you are. You have to make it who, like, a part of your identity. So what I started doing is I started jotting down, okay, how many hours do I have in a particular week? You know, okay, so I have 10 hours. At the time, I was a very busy college student. I was actually doing music for churches professionally during the weekend. So I didn't have a lot of time to build my real estate career. And I'm going to guess that a lot of people listening to this, probably you're on your way to work or you're coming home from work, right? And you don't have a lot of time as well, right? So what I started doing is I literally sat down, got a sheet of paper, and I asked myself, okay, I have 10 hours every single week. Number one, what are the things I could be doing during those 10 hours that is the highest and best use of that 10 hours? So what can I do to be most efficient? And I would write out some ideas, and I would reverse engineer what my action steps needed to be. So I would take a goal. And at the time, my goal was, you know, January 1st of 2017 is when I started doing deals. I got into real estate in 2014. So it was 3 years of just me learning and not doing anything, which, by the way, is absolutely okay. So January 1st, 2017, I told myself, I'm going to have 20 doors. My mentor was very smart enough to tell me, Daniel, don't set goals, set standards and expectations for yourself. And I was inspired by that because, you know, I read an article by Michael Phelps talking about how, you know, I am the most decorated Olympian is because my standards that I hold to myself every single day happens to be the most productive day for any other Olympian, right? So that is my standard. So I reverse engineered. My goal was 20 rental doors by the end of 2017. I worked backwards. I said, okay, if I want to get those 20 doors, what do I have to do before closing? Okay, before that, what do I have to do before that, before that, before that, to the point where I came up with 5 things that I needed to do every single day that were going to take me X amount of hours. I also created a separate list of 3 things I need to do every single week. And then I created a separate list of 1 thing I need to do every single month to ensure that the ball is being moved forward. Because what I told myself is, well, if I can achieve 1/12 of my yearly goal that month, I have done the right things to move the ball forward.
Right.
So I created what's known as KPIs, right? Key performance indicators, right? I set standards and expectations over my goals. So I took those standards and expectations and I brought them to my mentors. At this point, spent tens of thousands of dollars in coaching. And then I just submerged myself, right? Some of them were good, some of them were bad. Most of them were bad, which is why I started my own coaching. Because I was like, you know what? I kind of want to help people learn to do this the right way and not charge an arm and a leg. So, you know, here we are. And so I did those 5 things every single day, 3 things every single week, and 1 thing every single month. And by the time it was the end of 2017, I ended up with 87 and not 20, because I made it about the process and not about the result. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that a lot of people, especially those who are looking to scale their commercial portfolio, make, is they get so fixated on that goal that my recommendation would be, no, man, you know, focus on your process and focus on your, you know, standards and expectations. And I think even your goal will surprise you in terms of what you can achieve in a particular year. So I would say that's kind of where I got my start, how I got started, how I built my portfolio. And hopefully that was fast enough in terms of getting to good content.
Oh, no, man. I think that what you're hitting on some amazing content, I mean, already. And just, you know, the basic how to. I mean, that's the beginning, the 2 words of the show is how to. I mean, setting those standards, setting your KPIs. You know, I guess let's back up a little bit. I mean, there's two burning questions there. How does a kid with -$187 to his name spend tens of thousands of dollars on coaching?
Yeah. So, my brother and I, we called our credit card companies and we pretty much begged them to increase our maximum limit. Not what I would recommend for a lot of people. If anything, I wouldn't recommend that at all, right? But for us, for him and I mean, we were young. Our DTI was awful. We were making no income. And we were just at a point where we were like, you know what? We got to go all in, you know? And we had means of, you know, creating income. Like, you know, him and I, we both kind of did this affiliate marketing thing at the time. And you know, that's kind of how we put food on the table for now. And, you know, like I said, I worked professionally as a musician and did a couple other things, just some side gigs. But yeah, that's how we kind of came up with the money to pay for our coaching.
That's awesome, man. That's courageous and also crazy. So, you know, well done on that front. Second question would be, how did you finance the 87 doors?
Yes.
Again, with a negative, or I guess at this point, you know, like you said, a DTI that made no sense at all. Like, how did you even get that done?
So I remember there was one story where I was at a networking event. I was 21 years old and I was talking to a commercial lender, right? So he had announced himself and, you know, like during these meetups and networking events, like it's pretty much an arena where everyone just beats their chest on how awesome they are, right?
Sure.
So this guy, I still remember what he looks like. He was like 6'1". He had a beard. He was like in his early 40s. And I remember having a conversation with him and I was telling him about what I wanted to do in real estate. And I was like, yeah, you know, my plan is to, because I wanted to network with him. He was the senior commercial lender of a decently sized bank in that area. So I was like, I got to get to know this guy. I got to build a relationship. And so I'm telling him about all my aspirations and what I want to do. And he just starts asking me questions. He's like, all right, well, what's your DTI? Like, you know, what's your income? Like, what's your this? What's that? Like, have you had any experience? And obviously I had no experience at the time. And literally afterwards, I tell him, like, I want to do 20 doors by the end of next year. And he's like, oh, wait, you're serious. Like, he does one of those things. And I'm like, well, yeah. You know, he's like, kid, there's no way you're going to get it. Like, even if you come to we're not even going to let you in my office. You know, like, you're nuts, you know? And so I'm like, okay, I can't do bank financing. Like, what's my option here, right? Like, am I going to have to buy these cash? Like, am I going to have to raise capital? And, you know, like, what am I supposed to do here? So it was around that time when I learned this thing called seller financing. And I was like, interesting. And, you know, this concept is pretty much when the seller or the owner finances and carries a note for your purchase. So I started asking myself, how can I get this done? How can I be resourceful, right? Like the great Tony Robbins says, you know, never think about your resources, think about your resourcefulness. Mm-hmm. And so I started asking myself, how can I create a situation where people actually want this? So So what I did is I sat down and I reverse engineered my problem into a solution and then my solution into an action step, right? And that's one of the things I noticed a lot of people don't know how to do. And because they don't possess this skill, a lot of them have a hard time scaling their commercial portfolio, right? So I'll say it again. It's how can I take my problem, reverse engineer it into a solution, engineer that into a blueprint, and reverse engineer that into a daily action step? So I started asking myself, I sat down and I wrote all the value propositions of seller financing for the seller, right? So I write, okay, like potential tax deference, they make money as the bank, right? So like they're making money off of the interest, right? We all know that the banks are some of the largest and most rich entities in the world. I wrote down, okay, it promotes a lifestyle, right? Like if you're having your money work for you, then you're able to go out and travel and you're receiving a mortgage payment you yourself, and you don't have to manage the tenants, which is another thing I wrote down. Like don't have to manage, you know, tenants, toilets, termites, right? That terminology. And I came up with a list of about like 6 to 7. And I started asking myself from there, it's like, okay, who do I know that these 6, 7 things make the most sense for?
Mm.
Right? Like who would raise their hand and say, hey, I need those 6, 7 things. And after about a week of asking different mentors and, you know, talking to CPAs and attorneys and friends of mine and colleagues, I came up with the answer of older landlords, like
right.
Seasoned landlords. I'll be nice. Seasoned landlords. And it just made so much sense after somebody told me because, hey, like they're at an age where they probably need a lot of tax deference because, you know, they've owned it probably for more than 27 and a half years. They've got a big depreciation recapture event coming up. Not only that, but the value of the real estate has increased over the last 30 years. So they're paying a pretty high substantial capital gains tax, right? So, and this is like back in 2017, right?
And they probably don't even want to deal with, you know, being a landlord anymore.
Absolutely, right? That was another reason.
Yeah,
they don't want to wake up at 2 a.m. and, you know, unclock toilet or whatever, you know, and, you know, they're also at the age where they want to travel, right? So they want a particular lifestyle, right? What do they say? The golden years, right? Is what they call it. So I asked myself, okay, I need to go after older landlords who are above the age of 65, because I, you know, I still want it to make sense for them to still take on a note, right? Because there's no use of being 90 and going like, oh yeah, 30 year note, that sounds great, kid, you know? Right. So I started targeting landlords between the ages like 65 and like 85, right? Or 80. So I started asking myself, okay, what can I do to reverse engineer action steps around targeting older landlords? So for me, it started with, well, certainly I'm not going to go on, you know, a very fancy tech heavy website where it's like super complicated to set up, right? So I decided to go, what are some of the old fashioned ways that people promote property? So what I did from that point is I would meet with property managers who had been around the area for 30, 40 years, who have been doing business for a very long time. And I would ask them, hey, what were some of the best ways to lease apartments 30 years ago? Like back in the 90s, back in the 80s, like what were some of the ways people did that? And the main three I got was, well, number one, relationships, right? So like a leasing broker or a property manager. And then number two was like a for rent sign out front in the lawn. And then number three, newspapers. So I started assigning myself, okay, these are my action steps. I'm going to spend 3-4 hours every week, you know, going around, driving around, calling for rent signs. That's what I'm going to do. And sure enough, like, you know, 65% of people that pick up the phone, like, hello, right? I don't know how, I'm not saying that's how they sound, right? But you know, I'd be like, oh, if you don't mind me asking, you know, like, you know, you sound young, how old are you? And they say, oh, I'm 68, you know? And I'm like, oh, great. And inside I'm like, yes, right? So I would call for rent signs, I would call newspaper ads. And what I did is I would build relationships with property managers where I would tell them like, hey, if you have a client that's looking to sell, have them call me instead because I'll use you as the property manager. Therefore you never lose business.
Right.
And so property managers will love it. They're like, oh my gosh, like you're virtually guaranteeing me that I never lose units under management. And so I created a win-win. I said, look, worst case scenario, if we don't work out as management, right, you can take the commission as the broker. You know, so you make 2.5% on a $1.5 million apartment complex, you know, and worst case scenario, you make that money and you don't get the management.
Right.
Right. So I was getting deals sent to me left and right from different property managers I had that arrangement with. And as a matter of fact, my first 60 doors were from property managers and I bought them seller financing. It was neat, right? Because for a lot of these older landlords, they wanted that monthly payment to be higher. Because I mean, they were in a position where they already had lump sums of cash. Like they didn't need a crazy down payment. So my average down payment I would give these guys was 10%. I bought a couple of apartment buildings, no money down too. That's how great it was.
You've hit on a lot of things. One, some very direct and easy ways, or not easy. What do they say? It's not
simple.
Yeah, not in it. Yeah, it's simple ways, but it requires, it just requires, you know, the discipline yeah. to do it. It's not,
that's a great word.
It's not challenging. It's like eating on a clean diet. Like, it's not hard. It's just discipline. So yeah. I think that's a great example that you've set there. Naysayers, let's rewind a little bit. How did you overcome, you know, a lot of people stop. They stop right there when the, you know, commercial lender says, dude, I wouldn't even let you in my door. Like,
yeah.
And they kind of laugh you off the stage. So how did you not internalize that? And then how did you overcome the people in your life that said, nah, you can't do that?
Yeah. So the first thing you can't do is get defensive, sure. right? Because there are people who are like, oh, I'm going to prove them wrong, you know, whatever. And it's like, well, you can't do that because one day, like, you're going to need them,
right.
you know? So, you know, what I said in that situation, I said, yeah, like, you're right. You know, because at the end of the day, like, I'm an advocate of the truth, right? And the truth was, is that it was in his best interest to not let me in the door.
Right.
Because, you know, I'm the guy that's going to waste his time. So it's like, all right, like, if I was in his situation, I probably would have done the same thing. I wouldn't have said it that way. You know, I would have been a little nicer about it. I would say, hey, like, let me help you. But, you know, I probably would have had the same thoughts, just would have reacted differently. And same thing when I was raising capital, you know, as a 22-year-old, as a 21-year-old, I mean, I was fully aware that these 60, 50-year-olds that I was talking to, they knew, they like, that was one of their main reservations, that how is this young kid going to deliver results, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wrote these things down, you know, before I even talked to these individuals. And a lot of it, as cheesy as it sounds, comes from compassion, right? It just comes from putting yourself in their position. And that's exactly what I did. And that's kind of how I overcame it, right? It's just like, number one, value the truth above all things. Number two, like, see it from their perspective. And right. I think if you see it from their perspective, like, you'd probably be thinking the same thing. And then number three is just, all right, like, what are then the most creative and resourceful ways that I could mitigate their fear and at the same time create and turn that into a positive? So even with my investors, one of the things I did is I partnered up with a property manager who was a lot older than I was. So at the time he was 60 and I was 23. And so I gave him equity, even though I didn't need to, right? Because I was already giving him a management fee. He was making money as a broker. Like, he was already well compensated for doing the things that he's already doing. But like, I gave him a good chunk of the deal because like, I wanted him to have some skin in the game. So that's what kind of eased my mind of the investors. Like, hey, like, I got this guy, he's 60. And they're like, oh, okay. Right. And so I found a way to, you know, turn a negative into a positive.
Yeah, man, that is fantastic. So let's fast forward a bit here and talk a little bit about where you guys are today. I know you are in the process of developing a product, or you have developed a product called a core satellite fund. What is that?
Yes.
What does it mean and how does it work?
So it's not as scary as people think. It's actually quite simple. So long story short, I was at a point where, you know, about 3 years ago, I was just, you know, kind of in a rut, you know, I mean, and I'm a guy that gets bored very easily. You know, I'm like, I'm always going to be finding new ways to, you know, solve a problem faster, quicker, better, and more efficiently. And so about 3 years ago, I had to stop because I was in a rut. I was raising capital, doing deals. And it was just a cycle, right? Like, I was at a point where I was buying an apartment every month and I was constantly raising capital. Like, I was a rock star. I was actually traveling all over the country. There was a couple of larger real estate investment education companies that actually asked me to travel for them. So I would travel and, you know, I'd be in three cities every week. I mean, to give you an idea, my schedule was like wake up at Tuesday at 4 a.m., go to Minneapolis, and then run a 3-hour training that night, go to bed at like 1, wake up at 5 again, sleep a little bit on the airplane, go to Philly on Wednesday, and then go to D.C. on Thursday night, fly back to Chicago, which is my home, on Friday, and then run another training for 3 hours. And then Saturdays and Mondays were like my days where I focused on my real estate business, right? And did some things in the beginning. So I was kind of in a rut. I was like, man, is this what I want to keep doing for the next 30, 40 years, which is just buying an apartment, raising capital, buying an apartment. And I wanted to do something bigger, right? Like, I wanted to create a vehicle where one day I can help, you know, the children in need. I can help the widow, the hungry, the fatherless, the homeless, because that's why I started this thing, right? Like, I had no interest in making millions of dollars, right? Like, I do pretty well for myself today financially, but I still drive a Hyundai, right? Like, my wife and I still live in a 3-bedroom apartment And, you know, I'm wearing a hoodie right now, right? Like, I don't have Rolexes or whatever. My brother, on the other hand, he's a little flashier than I am, but that's just me, right? So it's about to build something good, right? So I started going around investors that invest in my deals. And I asked them, like, hey, what are some things that you would love to invest in? Like, tell me your wish list. And some of the things they were telling me is like, well, Daniel, I love that you're raising money. We're putting money in deals. But one of my big concerns is like, there's no diversification. What happens if I put, you know, $5 million into this apartment complex or $200,000 into this apartment complex and that apartment complex goes down? Well, all my investments is done, right? My capital's gone. So they said, I wish I could invest into something that is kind of like a REIT, but allowed me to have tax benefits, allowed me to have ownership, allowed me to, you know, kind of like a hedge fund. Right. And as soon as somebody said hedge fund, I was like, ooh, like I know who to talk to. So whenever I have a problem, my typical go-to is I try to figure it out myself. And then the next day I'll bring it to like three or five of my friends who know that thing very well. I masterminded a little bit, wrote some thoughts down, and I brought it to my friend, Kevin. And Kevin's my business partner today. But Kevin's a little older than I am. He's 52, which, by the way, now in hindsight is not that old. But he spent, to give you an idea, like 30 years in Wall Street. He was actually one of the smartest private investment managers at a company called Wachovia. He was most notable for predicting the last two economic recessions. So he actually saw 2008 coming before Michael Burry did. And then he also saw the dot-com bubble happening 4 years before it happened. And so he had written a couple books about it too. Somebody who I really respected. So I was like, I got to get this guy's advice. So him and I pretty much sat down and he helped me kind of create a model for investing in real estate. And long story short, I persuaded him to be my business partner and re-enter the fund space, even though he left not wanting to return. And so he came back into the fund space. We started the very first kind of real estate hedge fund, right? So we started the first hedge fund within the real estate space, where the core satellite model is we have our core fund where, you know, we invest in multifamily developments and commercial. And then we have satellites that are opportunistic, because one of the big questions I have is, well, I think a lot of people in the real estate industry can all raise their hand and agree that there's going to be some type of correction that's going to happen within the next 3 to 5 years. Sure. Now, the big question is, how do guys like us who own real estate funds find the liquidity to maneuver those market conditions? Because one of the things that happens automatically is undercapitalization. People don't have as much liquid as they thought they did, you know, when the market corrects. So my partner, Kevin, and I created a model where we have a structure where we have our core, where we invest into things that we know are going to last the next 10, 15 years. But we also have these little satellites that are opportunistic, that when opportunities arise, we have these satellites available and the liquidity available to jump at those opportunities. And so we designed a both opportunistic and kind of long-term, right? It's very much of long-term and short-term play, combining those together to where, hey, we will provide great returns every single year in assets that are very solidified, which, by the way, we're practicing this model in the second fastest growing economic county in America. And this is where we're implementing this model, right? This is the arena we're doing this in, the second fastest economic growing county in America. And so we also have these satellites to where if market corrections happen, we're ready and we have the liquidity to attack and be super opportunistic. Because there are people who made a lot of money in 2008. You know, and it just seems that it was either one or the other, right? Like you either lost a crap ton of money or you made a crap ton of money.
Right.
And we wanted to create a model where we still make a crap ton of money, but we don't lose money either. So we've got a couple of development projects right now that were super exciting. They're a little bigger, but the way that we've positioned our fund is as long as somebody has $250,000, as long as they're accredited, they can be involved in these large projects. They can be involved in our core satellite model. And they can have not only their money protected, but they can also have very opportunistic returns coming their way. So it's exciting because we were actually giving away. And I was a little hesitant with this one, but my partner, Kevin, was like, no, like, I think we should build it this way. But we actually give 100% of ownership away to our limited partners. And not only that, but our fee structure is very advantageous to them. They get 100% of the tax benefits. So we operate very much. We have the diversification of a REIT, but we also give away, you know, the benefits of ownership like you would with a syndication. And then we also added in some really cool bells and whistles on top of that. So very drawn out answer to your question, very long and hopefully not tedious, but that's kind of what I've got working on now. And then we've got a couple of development projects we're really excited for in the pipeline currently.
Man, that's fun. I love that. I love just the transition, you know, from the hustle and grind at the street level, which I'm sure that's still is going on in some form and fashion, that never goes away, don't think, but also just looking to grow and looking to do bigger deals and doing it in a systematic way with more seasoned partners. A lot of questions about the fund, you know, that I think are kind of popping up in my head. You know, we don't have time to dig into that on the show right now. I think this would be a good opportunity if you are curious and listening to this to reach out to Daniel and say, hey, how is this structured and see if it's a fit? Because that's, there's a lot of mechanics on that, that again, we could probably spend the next 30 minutes talking about the mechanics of the fund. But I think that's really fascinating. I really enjoyed this today, Daniel. I guess with, you know, the things you've mentioned here, I'm going to ask you a couple of definition.
Yeah, please.
How would you define success? And what does that mean for you? Say you're at the end of your life looking back and you said, I was a success or I was not a success. How would you define that?
Yeah. So the way I would define success is, you know, who is, again, this is going to sound so cheesy, but who are you? Right. So for me, it's, you know, one of the things I've had to learn recently is learning how to prioritize my wife over my business, right? Over my professional career. And, you know, that's something that I thought I did a good job, you know, but as of recently, you know, and I have a relationship with God. So I constantly talk to God. And one of the things that God has made aware in my life was, hey, man, you should prioritize your wife, but you should also prioritize you, right? So I'd say somebody who has their priorities in order, somebody who values their family, somebody who values their health, their mental health over what is, I don't want to say superficial, right? But over what the world would deem as success, you are a successful individual. So all in all, to kind of define that definition and wrap it up into one pretty sentence, I would say if you have your own clear defined definition of success and it's not what the world says success is, not what society says success is, I'd say you're a pretty successful person because it means you have clarity. And when you have clarity, you have, you know, you know where your energy is going towards and it's going towards the right places. I know guys who make 9 figures a year and, you know, their priorities are not in order. And they're at the end of their life. And, you know, I spoke to a guy a couple of days ago, I had breakfast with him, who has a lot of money, a lot of money. And, you know, he's been married to 4 different women. And this guy actually is borderline suicidal right now because he lives in this nice house and just it's just him. And if you ask him, hey, are you successful? I'm more than willing to bet that he's going to say, no, I'm not successful. Right. But yet the world and society would say, what are you talking about? Like you have 9 figures in the bank account. Like, that would be as cheesy as it sounds, right?
No, that's not cheesy at all. I love that. There's a Christian apologetics. Robbie Zacharias always said that some of the, you know, decamillionaire businessmen would sit in his office and weep because they got to the top and found out there's nothing there. Like it's that, oh my gosh, we worked all this. And yet that's a very devastating thought, but I love your definition there. Hand in hand with that impact. You know, what type of impact do you believe you have on other people?
Yeah, and that's a great word. People say like legacy. I'm not a big fan of the word legacy. So I've got a good friend of mine. His name is Alex Formosi, and I'm sure some of you guys have heard of him. But him and I had a conversation last week about what the word legacy means. And like he had brought up a really good comment. And by the way, the reason why I bring up his name is because I want him to get credit for this thought. But he says like, you know, I hate the word legacy because like the reality of the situation is like, legacy implies something that will last after you're gone, right? Like that's what people build towards. Like they want something for their kids and their kids get. And he goes, like, people don't realize that like by the time you get to like 4th or 5th generation down, no one has no idea who you are.
No idea.
Right. Like 100 years later, nobody has no idea who you are. Like, I doubt that you know who your great, 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 great grandfather is.
I don't even know my great grandfather's name.
That's exactly right. So like, I don't either. Right. And like, probably some guy with the Fu Manchu and like who lived in the mountains. I don't know. Right. Like most people don't even know the name of their great grandfather. Right. So for him, like what Alice brought up, he's like, dude, like legacy is such a poor word. But what he did say was impact. Like impact is the right word to kind of describe it. So for me, my impact is I just want to be a ripple. That's all I want. Like, I remember there was one time I was taking a walk and I was, you know, near my apartment complex, there's like a pond that kind of, there was buildings around that, right? And I was taking a walk and God was like, hey, pick up a pebble. And I was like, all right. He's like, throw it into the pond. I'm like, okay. And I threw it into the pond and it created a ripple effect. And surprisingly, the ripple went as far as like 90 feet. Like it kept going farther and farther and farther. And it created like bigger waves. Like the ripples got bigger as it expanded. And then it stopped because there was a fountain. Right. And God says, you are the pebble, right? Like what I want you to do in this lifetime will create ripples that will last for hundreds of years to the point where people will not even know your name, you know, of the impact that you caused. But he said, that's the beauty of it, because it's in that case, it's not about you.
Right.
Right. It's about me. Right. It's about God. Right. But it's also about the world. It's about the impact that you create. And so that was a pretty impactful moment for me. And that's what I strive to do in life. Right. It's like, whether it's, you know, especially with business, right. Cause money, people downplay money and it's like, oh, money doesn't buy you happiness. Well, it's pretty dang important, right? Like in, right. in this world, money gets people to do a lot of things, right? And a lot of good things. So for my hope is, hey, like the resources that I do attract and accumulate, even with our fund, right? Miati Partners Capital, that's the name of my private equity firm. We actually set up a foundation from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we take 10% of all our gross earnings on our side, not the investors, and we directly put it into the foundation. And one of the things that I did is in the area that we're doing investing in, you know, which is, again, the second fastest growing county economically in America, I spent an entire year building relationships with church pastors, community leaders, just asking them, like, what are the biggest hurts of the community? And I found out one of those things is affordable housing. And, you know, the other thing is they have a huge heroin crisis, but the other one's affordable housing. It's like, hey, I'm in real estate. Like, I can help with that. So that's one of the things that we're looking to do, because that's a big ripple in and of itself, right? So I would say my life when it comes to impact is just create as many ripples as I possibly can, you know, whether I'm 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, like I will create ripples until God calls me home.
Man, that's awesome. Daniel, I've certainly enjoyed this. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah. So I'm a guy that loves people. I love having as many friends and connecting with people as much as possible. So I'll just give out my personal email. If that's okay.
Sure. Go for it.
Yeah. So my primary email is just Daniel, D-A-N-I-E-L at thequakbrothers.com, T-H-E-K-W-A-K, and then brothers.com. And then I have my email for my equity firm, but you know, I check both pretty regularly. So you can go to miatipartnerscapital.com and find me that way. But yeah, daniel@thequakbrothers.com is, I would say, is the email to reach me at.
Man, that's fantastic. Daniel, thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
Thanks, brother.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.